Hello, it's the goodbye to the Queen of Woo edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, circumcision, Oprah Winfrey, the police state, and an interview with Mr. Deity. Now let's begin episode 117.
Welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your born-again hockey fan. For those people who don't know, it was announced today in the news that Winnipeg has got back its NHL franchise. For those people who don't know as well, I am originally from Manitoba, so this is somewhat good news for me. Ethan, I understand you're a bit of a hockey buff yourself.
Yeah, a bit, yeah, just a tad. Long overdue, I think.
It is.
Very sad to see these half-empty arenas, more than half-empty, virtually empty arenas in the United States. Why not put a team in Canada where people will appreciate them?
Well, you know, and it's interesting too, right? I feel sorry for Atlanta. This is the second team they've lost.
Yeah.
Both times to Canadian cities.
Woo-hoo. That's right.
First one the Calgary Flames got, and Winnipeg Jets come to Winnipeg. But I really love the new technique the Winnipeg has stumbled across to help guarantee that it has a full stadium. Do you know what that new technique is?
What is it, John?
It's got like the smallest stadium in the NHL. So apparently it's like 1,000-plus seats smaller than the next smallest stadium out there,
yeah.
Which you think is crazy. But I bet you when you look at it and you see all the seats are full, you're going to say they were pretty smart.
Well, I bet you they'll try to expand that stadium as well. And who knows, if it turns out to be really popular, maybe they'll just build a whole new stadium for
it. Wow. Yeah. At taxpayer expense. But speaking of things coming and going.
Yes, coming and going. Oprah Winfrey has retired, and science everywhere breathes a sigh of release.
Well, some science. We should be fair. Oprah is kind of like a form of Bill Maher, right? She's
sure.
been a good defender of climate change. She was out there about health standards for meat, which I think you're mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
But she was also the queen of...
of woo. Well, so on May 25th, the world was forever changed when Oprah Winfrey finally retired after doing her show for 25 years. Did you ever watch her show?
Not knowingly. I mean, it has been on when I was channel surfing because she's been on for like forever. So yeah. It'd be kind of hard not to have seen her.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, many will remember her for her humanitarian work and her book club and her positive attitude. But I think us as skeptics will remember her more as the Queen of Woo and, well, some of the dubious things that she's promoted over the years. Now, Oprah has a media empire, and I don't think anyone has ever seen anything like this ever.
With the possible exception of Martha Stewart, but let's be fair, at least Oprah has kept her ass out of prison where Martha Stewart hasn't.
Right. Well, I think Oprah's empire exceeds Martha's reach by quite a bit as well. See, the problem with having such a huge empire of media is that Oprah's opinions get sent out to everywhere, and her voice takes on far more power than you or me or anyone else, really.
Which just goes with the classic saying, with great power comes great responsibility.
That's right. And in one case, because Oprah expressed her, her sort of disgust with the mad cow scare and the meat industry.
She just said that she was worried to eat meat because of mad cow disease.
She got sued by meat industry proponents, and it became this big court case of sort of a battle of free speech or for example, does Oprah as a media mogul have a responsibility to make sure her opinions are evidence-checked?
Okay.
And I perhaps skeptics would make that same argument. But one of the areas where Oprah's reach has been felt negatively is in the realm of science. And over her career, she's promoted dozens of dubious health treatments and bogus scientific theories. Now, the most obvious example, of course, is the anti-vax movement. Oprah has brought on the spokesperson for this campaign, Jenny McCarthy, many times to promote her disproven allegations that vaccines cause autism and are dangerous. You know, Oprah's unique position as a household name and marketing force gave the anti-vax movement more momentum than it ever should have had. According to a Jenny McCarthy body count website, which is a site that keeps a tally of all the deaths that result from vaccine-preventable illnesses that have occurred since McCarthy began her crusade against vaccines in the U.S., that number is currently at 727, and the number of preventable illnesses is set at 79,365. Now, I would imagine those numbers would be down quite a bit if Oprah hadn't given McCarthy a spotlight to promote her anti-science.
Yep.
You know, Oprah's demographic is mostly women, and most of them are mothers. They're, you know, daytime moms watching TV, right? So Oprah would market a lot of pseudoscience towards these mothers, and Jenny McCarthy is a good example of this, because Jenny would often say things like, my mommy instinct is more useful than a doctor's advice any day of the week. And this is a very silly argument to make. I don't think Jenny McCarthy has any experience diagnosing medical conditions whatsoever.
Well, I also can't help but feel that that's somehow, I don't know, patronizing or demeaning. It's like something to say, oh, it's just women's instinct. And like, yeah. As you know, and I don't know, it just seems negative on the outset. Have there ever been any research studies into the mommy instinct?
Well, the mommy instinct is, as you say, intuition. And I don't think there's been any study anywhere that would indicate that intuition has any basis in scientific theories. In fact, when we chatted with Rebecca Watson, look up the interview, folks, she described women's intuition as sort of the equivalent of male logic. You know, like men have math and science and evidence, and women have, you know, magic and women's intuition and, you know, the secret.
Sorry, you're coming across as a bit condescending, that women somehow are illogical, irrational, men are rational, logic. How did she kind of mean that?
Well, because, you see, Oprah is sort of marketing this sort of mythical version of women. This notion that a woman relies on her sense of intuition to navigate the world, when that's just sexism. Women, like men, are great at math and science and reasoning and critical thinking, and we all use these skills. I mean, you don't drive blindfolded and rely on your intuition to get you someplace.
I mean, there isn't such a thing as men math and women math. It's all just math.
It's all just math.
Wow.
It's not gendered at all, which is great. You know, Oprah sort of promotes this kind of, I guess you could call it spiritualism, and I guess spiritualism by itself isn't harmful, but Oprah doesn't seem to have any kind of filter of what spiritualism she promotes. So she would frequently have on her show people like Deepak Chopra or John of God, who is this con man faith healer who uses sleight of hand tricks to make people think that he's doing some kind of like magical psychic healing on them. And these tricks were debunked by James Randi on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, you know, a decade or so ago. It's quite commonly known how, you know, you take a chicken entrail in your palm of your hand and pull it out of someone's stomach.
Well, you know, and I think it does a great disservice, too, to women and all that. Because, I mean, one of the things I think you're kind of hinting on, you know, the idea of spiritualism, which is not innately bad, is that, I mean, women do have a slightly different way of looking at the world. Because we do have a bifurcated cultural society, right? Although we have the same sort of equipment to come up with logical, because culture has put us into different roles. I mean, women do have a different way of looking at things. There is, you know, they have, you know, the culture of caring, which is an ethics school in logic, and that where, well, I'm sorry, in ethics. So, I mean, you know, there is a lot of things she could have brought to the table that would have sort of promoted this, you know, female feminist sort of look on the world. But instead of promoting that as much as she has, she somehow got deceived. I mean, do you think it's willful deceit, or do you,
it's really hard to say with this. I mean, I'm sort of leaning towards the assumption that Oprah thinks she knows what's best for people. And if Deepak Chopra and John of God make even one person more spiritual, which is clearly what Oprah wants in the world. I mean, if you look at a lot of what she's been saying on her show, not just relating to science, but just in terms of life in general. She wants people to be more spiritual and more in tune with their emotions and that. And sure, being attuned to your emotions is great. It's a wonderful thing. But when you're promoting somebody who will take thousands of dollars for you and, you know, starve you half to death on some retreat in India or perform psychic surgery on you in Brazil, that's just being irresponsible. And it's hard to say what Oprah really thinks. I can't get inside her head. I don't really want to get inside her head. But, you know, it's
dubious.
Can't
John of God do that for you?
Well, I don't want him inside my head either, that's for sure. One area that Oprah's legacy is going to be felt is in the people who she's given talk shows and given a platform to speak. So, for example, there's Dr. Phil McGraw, who is apparently a psychologist, although my big question is, what is he a psychologist of?
Actually, someone asked me this the other day, and he is a clinical psychologist. He's got his PhD from Texas University. Mm-hmm. Before Oprah found him, though, he was actually a court psychologist who was intended to do sort of crime scene investigation sort of stuff, not CSI, but more of a psychology version of that. So he has some credentials, but I think this is where Oprah tends to go off the thing. Because he's a doctor, therefore everything he says must be valid and true. Mm-hmm. So when he sits there and he does his little hokum thing saying, well, you're addicted to crack. Well, you just got to solve it yourself because you're the fault of your own problems. And if you know, I mean, he's got all this hokum as his advice. Yeah. And
I sort of characterize it as he does a kind of pop psychology with sort of down-to-earth psychobabble with a charming Texas accent, you know, and that's really not where you want to go when you have a deep problem, right? The other thing that kind of irks me about Dr. Phil is that he's actually been brought before his board on various charges of not like malpractice, but having improper relations with patients. And I don't mean not like sexual relations. I mean like things like going into business with them and stuff like that. He's also been promoting things like weight loss medication, which he's not qualified to do. He's not a physician.
Oh.
So dubious there. But I think the worst of all, the absolute cream of the crop of bad science is Dr. Oz. This is the person that Oprah would bring on the show to talk about science-based medicine, or so we would think.
Right.
When we first came on, it was sort of like, okay, there's a doctor. He's kind of a little strange, but he does talk about science, right? But eventually Oprah gave this Dr. Oz, this Dr. Mehmet Oz, his own TV show, and he's pretty much promoted every dubious alternative medical treatment you can think of. He's done shows on homeopathy. The worst, most egregious thing he did was he brought on John Edwards, a self-proclaimed psychic, for a segment called Are Psychics the New Therapists? And gave this charlatan a national stage to promote his
crossing over
mentality.
Here I thought you were going to say, you know, are psychics the new therapist? No. But no, he didn't go that way. He thought, you know, hey, I'm in this for the money or some such thing. And he just gave the guy a stage to promote his own economic interests, both Oz's and
I mean, listeners may have remembered Dr. Novella, Steve Novella, the host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, was actually on Dr. Oz's show. And he did a reasonably good job. I mean, when you go onto someone's show who has completely etiquette control of what the listener sees, right? But he came across pretty well, although Dr. Oz always got the last word in. And, you know, it was an interesting segment, but ultimately I think, you know, Oz has really crossed over to the dark side on this one. He really doesn't seem to understand why promoting someone like John Edwards is a really, really bad idea.
So let's do a little recap then, and Ethan, I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Sure.
I know you weren't prepared for this, but you said you had Dr. Novella and you had Dr. Oz. They're both doctors. Why should I believe Dr. Novella is a more credible source for information than Dr. Oz? What kind of criteria, if I was listening to one of these shows, what criteria do you think I should bring to it?
Well, you know, it's tough. You shouldn't just assume that because someone has a couple letters in front of their name, they're a trustworthy source. But I mean, you want to measure whatever they say with some level of skepticism. So, you know, if Dr. Oz is up there talking about homeopathy and he's saying, you know, this little pill that's, you know, got the memory of water diluted over to a, over a sugar pill is going to cure cancer, you have to kind of measure that against what you already know about cancer. You have to measure whether or not that's in line with the consensus view of science. And I mean, this kind of goes back to the whole problem of you shouldn't get your medical advice from a daytime talk show in the first place.
Even if it was novellas.
Even if it was novellas, I would say this is not the right forum for dealing out health advice. You know, it's like the call-in, it's like the Fraser Crane show, right? You call into a psychiatrist on the radio, I don't know. You need to sit down with somebody and actually explain the situation to them.
And to be fair, anyone who's listened to the SGU, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, whenever they try and put a medical question to Dr. Novella, he says, you know, well, listen, you know, this is not really the forum to do it, mm-hmm. and I might give you a flippant answer, but take note, this is just off the top of my head, and if you really do have a problem, go see a doctor who can get the complete story about what you really do need.
Yeah. The great thing about, you know, what Dr. Novella does is he doesn't try to give out medical advice. He uses his experience to weigh in on medical claims. So I'm sure they'll be talking about some new cancer treatment or something, and he'll say, well, you know, in my experience, here's what I've seen, here's what I think. But he doesn't say, as a doctor, I recommend you take such and such, right?
Well, and he also, when he does use his experience, it's also science-based. As in,
absolutely,
it's
yeah.
not anecdotal, it's not, this is the latest trend, there are studies, etc., behind it that have shown consistently, because even when they do kind of corner him on a new study, he says, well, I'm going to wait to see if this has been confirmed, or if there's, you know, some confounding factor to this.
Right. Well, let's go to a commercial break. We'll be back with more here on Radio Freethinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So, Don, we got an email from a listener.
We did. We received a letter from a loyal listener, thanks, Aaron, who is asking us whether circumcision was really a valid method of HIV infection prevention or just an attempt by, quote, Westerners to impose a religious tradition on a vulnerable population, i.e. in the context of Africa and the spread of AIDS. First things first, when we talk about this, we're referring to male circumcision and not female genital mutilation. There should be no confusion that the two are even remotely similar. So, that being said, the first question we should ask, so...
Does circumcision reduce HIV transmission?
Thank you, yeah. So, does it? Well, the scientific evidence actually seems quite clear on this. Circumcision does reduce HIV transmission in the male population by over 60% and transmission to women by 50%. This is based upon a large number of peer-reviewed, independent, randomized studies. This is not done by one corporation who's intent on promoting a particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
So the science seems clear that circumcision does help prevent the spread of AIDS. Now, in your own research, and we always recommend listeners to do their own research, as much as trustworthy as we are,
mm-hmm.
always go for your own, you may find some studies that report to show circumcision in the North American context has no effect on HIV transmission, raising, of course, the question as to the true effectiveness of the procedure and perhaps a double standard between here and there. Now, these studies, from what I've been able to decipher, are actually volunteer surveys where men are asked in a volunteer setting whether they'd be willing to go into a study for circumcision on HIV transmission and would be willing to be circumcised themselves. This shows that the apparent impact on HIV transmission would actually be minimal based on these surveys, because apparently a low number of men are willing to participate or have the procedure done to them. However, this is not actually a study of the effectiveness of circumcision, but a cultural willingness of men to be circumcised as adult. Also, the target population was the gay community, where HIV transmission via anal intercourse has a very different morphology than vaginal intercourse. So, you know, when it comes to the actual effectiveness of HIV, it is still shown, even in this particular case, to have a reduction. So there's also a very strong correlation between circumcision and the prevention of penile cancer. Although the mechanism itself is less understood, the vast, vast, vast majority of cases of penile cancer occur in uncircumcised men. The odds of developing penile cancer are magnitudes less in circumcised men. And if you've been circumcised at birth, it is so small that it is statistically non-existent.
Right.
So we've answered sort of the first question. Circumcision does help reduce the spreads of AIDS. So, you know, the next question maybe we should ask is that, well, you know, as a good atheist, maybe we shouldn't promote a religious practice. I mean, circumcision is very much associated with the Judeo faith. And that, you know, maybe, you know, because it does have this overt association with Judaism and the West, that we are somehow unwillingly supporting or advocating a form of Western colonialism, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when I did some research into this, I guess my answer is no or yes, depending on how we should support the practice of circumcision, because really it's been a historical accident that the practice is associated with Judaism. It's also a Western attitude, because a vast majority of religiously circumcised men in the world are actually Muslim and not Jewish. And if you do a little more historical research into it, circumcision has a very, very long tradition. It's not actually exclusively associated with Judaism or even the Abrahamic religions. It was a practice in pharaonic Egypt, you know, when the pharaohs pre all that, right? Mm-hmm. It's a rite of passage still in parts of Western Africa. So that being said, you know, I don't feel comfortable when missions like this are somewhat overly stressed the religious nature of it. I heard of one particular case of a mission to Africa called Operation Abraham, where a team of, quote, practiced Israeli doctors were doing mass circumcision of men in Africa. That being said, I don't like it when churches have soup kitchens either, right? And there's an overt thing there. But until we're able to, you know, provide the resources to do this in a secular area, until we can pony up and do it ourselves without these religious things, I think in the essence of harm reduction, we hold our noses and say, you know, at least in the long run, it's doing good, and maybe we should be going in there and making sure there's not an overt message with it.
Right. I have noticed, though, that the science behind circumcision is not entirely cut and dry. I was looking at the notions, the numbers on penile cancer, and despite the fact that about 1 in 600 uncircumcised men in the U.S. will get penile cancer, the American Cancer Society doesn't consider circumcision a prevention strategy due to other factors like hygiene being more important. And this could also indicate why in like sub-Saharan Africa, circumcision is promoted, but in other more developed countries where, you know, safe sex and hygiene is more widely used, it's not really particularly necessary.
Well, actually, and you've stumbled across one of the other controversies that come into this. A number of people who tend to be in an ideological thing have an a priori sort of dislike for circumcision itself. They consider it to be a form of mutilation. Mm-hmm. So they tend to allow that to overcloud their issue. It's not intended to be circumcision only. It is supposed to be part of a package,
right,
of things to do that. And actually, that leads into another interesting area, is that, you know, some people have argued, you know, well, that if this is for AIDS production, AIDS prevention, right, HIV, how come low circumcised population in white countries, why aren't they promoting it there? And to understand this, right, I mean, first of all, we have to understand both the prevalence of circumcision and the prevalence of HIV infection. Now, the region in the world with the highest rate of circumcision is actually Saharan Africa, that's North and West Africa, and the Middle East, followed by North America. The regions with the lowest rate of circumcision are Europe, South America, and of course parts of sub-Saharan South Africa. Now, on this information alone, one again could jump to the conclusion and say, well, hey, you know, aren't you practicing a double standard? Why aren't you sending missions into Eastern or Western Europe and having them? Well, then you have to go contrast that, the cultural practice with the medical need. Now, if we look at the prevalence of HIV infections and the deaths from AIDS, we see that actually the highest rates are in sub-Saharan Africa, while Europe has some of the lowest. Now, I'm sure this discrepancy has a lot more to do with links between poverty and underdeveloped medical infrastructures, but nonetheless, it's there. Mm-hmm. And just to throw in my kick at the can, the fact that the Catholic Church is much more stronger promoting the disuse of condoms in Africa, whereas they don't seem to do it quite as much in more developed countries. But if you look at the prevalence of HIV in Eastern Europe, it's about 0.8%, South America 0.5%, Western Europe 0.2%. Contrast that with sub-Saharan Africa, which has 5%, where 1.2 million people have died in 2009, that's the stats I was looking at, died, where you get, I think, Western Europe had 8,000 who died, right? So when you contrast the prevalence of circumcision and the need to reduce HIV transmission, it doesn't seem to be a form of cultural imperialism. And let's take one step back. Let's say, okay, it is cultural imperialism. Great. In the essence of harm reduction, I don't see why we wouldn't even promote it. I mean, for example, I'm going to go Godwin on you here, but let's give okay. give me the break. The Nazis believed in jet airplanes. Does that mean we should abandon jet airplanes because it's associated with the Nazis? Well, no. I mean, if it's a valid method that happens to be used by something that we think is despicable and we don't like, right, then it still should be promoted in spite of its association.
Yeah, I mean, if it works, then it's a useful tool. And we have to be able to divorce the ideas from the people who came up with the ideas, or even the people who just used the ideas in general, right? Like, you can say the same thing, you know, mustaches. Well, Hitler had a mustache. Ergo, mustaches are bad.
You know, and actually this falls into an interesting thing, because in an odd sort of way, it is very, very effective for Africa, where the Catholic Church, and I'm kicking on them again, has a big resurgence. They've got growing adherence to that, right? But they have this big thing about condoms. And condoms, so far from what I understand, is actually the most effective way to prevent HIV transmission. And the Catholic Church says, no condoms. But ironically enough, they have no prohibition against circumcision, provided it's not for religious reasons. But if you're just doing it for medical reasons, they say, snip away, no problem. So in an odd sort of way, it is not only effective, but it's almost tailor-made for this particular community that has these other cultural baggage to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, yeah, and it is a kind of tricky question in that regard. Like, why would the Catholic Church be willing to promote one avenue of sort of healthy living versus, but not another avenue?
Well, we know why.
Well, we know why. But I mean,
every sperm is sacred.
Sure it is. Yeah, we should have the song queued up, but we don't.
So there is one last thing that we haven't touched on this, and I think we're pretty much at the end of this, and I don't want to go into this, but if you're interested to go into this, send us your feedback. The idea of circumcising children in North America, where we don't necessarily have the health need to do it here. Mm-hmm. And there is probably a good discussion to be made about, is it right or is it wrong to circumcise prenatal children? Young children.
Sure, right.
Or not. And if you're interested for us to go into that, send us your email and let us know at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. And we can do that if you want us to.
Yeah, that'd be a great topic. Well, let's go to a commercial break. When we come back, we have an interview, one of our few more interviews from Kamloops.
With God,
Brian Dalton, a.k.a. Mr. Deity. And guess what? Today is Brian's birthday.
Happy birthday, Brian.
And stay tuned for that interview up next on Radio Free Thinker.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
Pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
Mm-hmm. idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic.
It's Venus. Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it? The other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hi, this is the Gearing Up Inventors. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is Brian Dalton. Brian plays the role of God on the internet TV show Mr. Deity, in which he also directs and writes. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, enjoying the conference so far?
Yeah, it's great. Great. Seen a lot of good stuff and got to, you know, I love whenever I get to hang out with PZ. I'm good.
Excellent. So tell us about Mr. Deity. Where did the idea come from?
The idea was basically a response to the Indonesian tsunami in 2004. I was seeing a lot of people, you know, asking where was God, and you know, the whole problem of evil thing is, you know, you can get God out of that to a certain extent, but natural disasters are one of those where it's hard to, you know, it's really hard to get him out of it. So I had written this little thing about the creation and how, you know, we really don't need the natural disasters, but Mr. Deity wants to keep them in for some.
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is Brian Dalton. Brian plays the role of God on the internet TV show Mr. Deity, in which he also directs and writes. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, enjoying the conference so far?
Yeah, it's great. Great. Seen a lot of good stuff and got to, you know, I love whenever I get to hang out with PZ. I'm good.
Excellent. So tell us about Mr. Deity. Where did the idea come from?
The idea was basically a response to the Indonesian tsunami in 2004. I was seeing a lot of people, you know, asking where was God, and you know, the whole problem of evil thing is, you know, you can get God out of that to a certain extent, but natural disasters are one of those where it's hard to, you know, it's really hard to get him out of it. So I had written this little thing about the creation and how, you know, we really don't need the natural disasters, but Mr. Deity wants to keep them in for some crazy reason. And that was it. That was the beginning of it. I sent that around to a few friends, and I never had any idea of acting in it. I had directed before, and I just thought, oh, you know, I'll get some actor friends, and no one wanted to do it. So we sat on it for over 2 years, I think, and then Jimbo finally got me to, who plays Larry on the show, got me to, he said, let's just shoot one, see how it goes. Mm-hmm. And that was it.
So you're playing God. How do you get into character?
Well, the character is loosely based on me. It's not hard to get into this character. He's a real creative type with no follow through, and that's you know, I get great ideas, but and that's the end of it. So that's what the universe feels like, isn't it? It's like somebody had a really great idea and then just dropped the ball, you know, about halfway through. So I do that, and I thought of him. You know, the whole vibe of the show is basically that this is kind of like an indie universe. He's like an indie film producer. You know, they have crap budgets. They got to do things on a shoestring, and nothing ever goes right, and it's never how you wanted it to work out. But he's plugging away anyway. So that's the show. The only thing that I would say that I do with the character that I've planned on doing from the beginning is I always felt like Mr. Deity shouldn't be able to look anyone in the eye for a long time. Mm-hmm. So That's the only like character thing that I really have to focus on. Don't look somebody in the eye. Look off. Look away, because he's always at risk. You know, to me, someone's always about to find him out. You know, call him out and say what the hell. So he just tries to avoid eye contact for long durations. So other than that, it's very easy. I just get in there and kind of do it. And then I have people that I'm ripping off. My great comic heroes, Bob Newhart, Woody Allen, Bob Hope. And there's someone else that I do. Basically, I just rip off people I like with the mannerisms and the stuttering and all that kind of stuff. So.
Right. And the god that you play is a very disinterested, very sort of self-absorbed god. Self-absorbed like the biblical god, but he's not terribly interested in what happens to the humans he created.
He's not. He's really not. He wants certain things from them, and other than that, he's kind of a. He's much more. He's a little bit more of a live and let live god than the god. Certainly of the god of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, and it really. I mean, it's all about him. I mean, we kind of said it. It's funny when you write the show, you end up finding ways to say things that I've had kind of viscerally floating around in my head forever and ever, but I didn't know how to get them out. One of my favorite lines in one of the recent episodes is when we're talking about hell, and John the Baptist says, you know, well, isn't it more important that they treat each other kindly than believe in you? And he's, no, you'd think so, but no. And then he says, well, you know, if you're going to burn them in hell for everything, that makes everything all about you. And that's really what it comes down to with the Christian God. It's all about him. Mm-hmm. You know, what God wants most from us is our credulity. You know, that's the most important thing for him, that we be credulous and just believe whatever, you know, is said in his name. And it's a really strange idea when you stop and think about it. But that's what we try to do with the show. We try to get people to go, okay, this is what you believe. Do you really? Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of what we do.
And so the show is a form of satire, but do you think that it sort of has this sort of double meaning, that it tries to make people kind of go, that's funny, but wait a second?
Yes, very much, very much. There was a study... I don't do it this way because I read the study, because the study came after. I can't remember where it was from, but it was talking about how, in terms of getting people to change their mind about things, one of the best ways to get them to do that is to concretize kind of an abstract belief. And religion is a lot of abstract belief. You know, we say we believe in an all-knowing, all-loving, all-powerful God who's outside time. So, for instance, we do an episode where we kind of point out, you know, what does that mean to be outside of time? Do any of us have any concept of what that means? We talk about it, and for instance, how does that manifest itself? For instance, how does God, you know, the Christian God is said to have created time. Time didn't exist, and then he created it. Well, that requires time. Time already has to be there, because at one moment it didn't exist and then the next moment it did. So you have to create time. It's mind-boggling. So you do these things, and then you it's a way for people to kind of go, yeah, there's a problem there. Or yeah. Or with the notion that you know, we need tsunamis and earthquakes and floods and that kind of stuff. And concretizing is a big part of the show, and that's the part of it that's beyond the humor. It's also trying to, I mean, satire really is a little bit, it's always more than just humor. There's humor, and satire is always kind of trying to make a point,
right?
By getting you to think about it.
And what about the feedback the show has gotten? Was it expected, or were you kind of surprised by what you got?
I was really surprised, yeah, because we put up the first three episodes, and then someone mentioned it on Dig or something like that, and I started getting all these views. And then because it started getting all these views, you know, it's an avalanche, because then YouTube puts it on the front page because they think, oh, they've got something people want to see. And from that point on, I mean, it was almost immediate that we were getting calls from big media companies wanting to do something with them. And we did. For a season, we went with Sony. And we just kind of realized while we were there, this is probably not something that should be done with a big company.
was it creative control differences?
No, it wasn't creative control so much. It was a lot of it was the promotion or the lack thereof. And I think marketing people have a hard time figuring out how to promote this show.
Right.
They don't know who the audience is, and it's just difficult. It's a tough. You know, the whole center of the country, because I'm an American, is bass ackwards in terms of almost everything. So, unless you're on the coast, you know, the marketing people don't know how to pitch it to you.
Right.
So, yeah.
So let's talk about the characters. Lucifer or Lucy. What was the genesis behind making Lucifer God's on-again, off-again girlfriend?
Yeah, this is actually kind of a funny story. Amy, who I'm now married to, I wasn't when we started doing the show, she was married to my best friend, who had lost his mind basically 2 years before then and just done some things that were just ridiculous. And can you say midlife crisis? Can I say that?
You can say that.
So they were going through a divorce at the time, and I was starting to work on an episode about Lucifer, and I had never thought to make her a woman. And I had written a line, something about, it was, you know, Lucy, you got some splaining to do, because I thought it would be fun. Mr. Deedy would always screw with Lucifer by calling him Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling him that I'm doing an episode with, telling my old best friend, I'm doing an episode with Lucifer, and he said, oh, you should have Amy play that character. And I don't think there's a lack of coincidence by the fact that they were going through a divorce, and he was thinking of her as Satan. So I thought, oh, that's a great idea. She's fantastic, because she'd been in other things that I directed. So I thought, I gotta use her. That's a great idea. And then we just kind of hit it off. We'd been friends for 22 years, so it was an interesting evolution of our relationship and the character.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
What about the character of Larry? Is there any theological inspiration for God's assistant?
Yeah, not really, no. I always thought, you know, God's got to have, you know, basically the inspiration for Larry is Smithers on The Simpsons. I mean, he's not totally a yes man like Smithers. The way I think of it as a writer is, Larry is the heart of the show. Lucy or Lucifer is the brains of the show, and Jesus is the body of mm-hmm. the show because he's got the body.
Right.
He's just this great looking, you know, guy who with a great voice, and he just kind of goes along with Mr. Deedy. But Larry's the guy who's kind of us. You have to throw someone in there who represents us and our way of thinking and everything. So Larry's always been the heart of the show.
Sir, you have to stop your people. You got to send down an angel, do something.
Stop what? What are they doing?
They're going to stone an innocent girl to death.
You're kidding. That's outrageous. What did she do?
Well, they're saying she's not a virgin.
Oh, well.
Huh. Well?
It's just, you know, if she's not a virgin.
Is she or isn't she?
Does it matter? They're going to stone her to death. They're going to kill her. And she could have just been, you know, riding horseback or something.
Well, she should have gone side saddle.
Did they catch her fornicating?
No!
Well, so then how do they know she's not a virgin?
Yeah.
She was married yesterday, and her husband takes her up to the room, and, you know, there was no...
No evidence of virtue.
Yeah, if you want to call it that.
Well, I don't know what you want me to do about
it. I want you to stop it.
That's their culture.
Their culture?
That's how they roll.
That's how they roll. This father probably put down a pretty penny for the dowry, yeah. And I'll bet the groom was expecting some USDA prime, not something that's already been chewed on. I'll bet he's ticked.
Yeah. Yeah. And this girl made her father look like a total schmuck.
Total schmuck. I
mean, his reputation will never be the same
never.
If he does nothing. He'll have no honor.
Larry, this guy thought he was driving off the lot in a brand new Caddy, and then he gets her home, pops the hood, and sees nothing but wear and tear. And there's no oil in the damn thing.
Dry motor.
I mean, if that doesn't deserve some kind of punishment, I don't know what does.
So do all the men have to be virgins too?
Why?
No, I don't know why that would be necessary.
Well, how do you work the math on that one? It takes two to tango.
Hey, look, I'm the first to admit I'm not good at math.
And he doesn't like to tango. He's
no.
more of a...
Disco.
Sir, come on. You know this isn't right.
I don't know that. And besides, what am I supposed to do about the prime directive? I'm just going to ignore that all of a sudden?
The what?
The prime directive.
Yeah, it states that we're not allowed to interfere with other cultures.
No interfering.
That's not our thing. That's Star Trek.
Really?
So So? It's still a good idea.
Yeah, so?
Sir, they're saying it was your idea to begin with.
Okay, I might have said something like that when I was hanging with Mo on the mount. I just had that big fight with Lucy about the whole virgin thing. She's always on me, you know that.
So see, you've been interfering since the beginning.
And what has it gotten me?
Okay, if you're not going to step in for the girl, what about your reputation?
My reputation?
Yeah, years from now, people are going to look back and say, right, these were Mr. Deity's people. He was calling the shots, and this is the kind of immoral thing he let go on. In fact, ordered, I'm going to listen to him, please.
Yeah, and I will have a simple, powerful two-word reply.
Tell him.
Prime directive.
Prime directive.
Well, you're a former Mormon.
Yeah, Foreman, as I say.
Yes, yes. I'm curious, what do you think of the sort of satire that's been done by, like, South Park and other shows like that about Mormonism?
I think South Park, the guys at South Park are absolutely brilliant. I mean, I am absolutely, truly stunned that they've been able to do the level of work that they've been doing for as long as they have. It's absolutely mind-boggling, and there's obviously so much talent. But I particularly like the Mormon stuff, you know, having been one of them, it's always fun to see what other people see in it. The episode where the little boy comes to town and he starts, you know, telling everybody the story of Mormonism and bringing them over, and they have a great family and all that, and they pick up on the whole Martin Harris thing about the lost 116 pages and they have to retranslate and all. You know, it's one of those things where even if after I was out of it, I didn't see how absurd that was because I had grown up with it my whole life. But that's a great example of satire, where satire gets you to see something that you can't even see, even though I'm out of it. And I see all the other ridiculous stuff, but it never occurred to me, oh, yeah, there are these lost 116 pages floating around. And then instead of retranslating them exactly, there's a whole other set of plates that contain a lot of that detail, but not exactly, so that he can't ever be tested, mm-hmm. you know, whether he really was translating from God or not. I just love them. I'm dying to see the play. I have some Foreman friends who went to New York the day it opened to go see it, and they all love it. And one of my benefactors has told me I'm going to be taking you out there to see it. So
cool.
That'll be fun.
The thing that I noticed about that episode in particular was that it wasn't mean-spirited.
Right.
It was satire, but it was kind of in a almost a sort of a friendly kind of, you know, wink wink way.
Right.
And I've noticed that about Mr. Deity too. It's not mean spirited. You're not trying to offend someone.
Right.
Is that intentional? Do you guys go out there?
I think so. I think it's also just part of my character. I can be like really in your face if you get in my face, but to the extent that I'm in control of this, it's not how I would do things. I admire And, you know, I secretly love the people, and I would love to be more like them, like a Christopher Hitchens. I just love him, and I love Richard Dawkins and the way they go at it. And I do, but I, you know, there's, I mean, that niche is kind of filled, you know what I mean? There's not a lot of desire for me to go that way, but there's also, you know, there's also studies that show satire is great because it makes people think while they're having a good emotion, a good feeling. And you're far more likely to consider ideas when you're feeling those good emotions. And I think humor is a great way to just open up people to these ideas and get them thinking a little more without being immediately put on the defensive.
Right.
You know, because when defensiveness is not, you can't think when you're defensive. You can't love. You can't do anything but defend the territory. You know, it's an awful thing. And humor is a great way to get around that. You just run right around.
Well, Brian, thanks for chatting with us on the show.
And thank you. This was
please,
great.
Please be a guest in the future.
I will.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables.
Beep, 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 beep
I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Enjoy these sounds. CITR is the home of amazing sounds. So listen to me always. 101.9. CITR.ca.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So our thanks to Brian Dalton for stopping by and chatting with us here on the show. Again, happy birthday, Brian. And you know who else's birthday it is today? Our guest from last week, Dr. Christopher DiCarlo.
Woohoo!
So double birthday on the skeptical free thought promoters.
Excellent.
Yes.
And of course, we know because of their astrological signs that because they were born in this particular zodiac, that's why they're level of logic is higher than the average ones. I really feel sorry for those people who are born in November where they use their mommy instincts much more than they did. Yeah, no, okay. I made it up. Sorry, folks.
Send your letters to Don McLennigan at Radio. Yes, well, we're kind of running out of time here on the show, so we should probably move on to our skeptical highlights. I have one, and that is tomorrow, June 1st, 7:30 p.m., is Skeptics in the Pub at the Billy Bishop Legion in Kitsilano, which is always a good place to go for a couple drinks and help hang out with your fellow skeptics. So come on by and join us for some drinks or two.
Anyone with a birthday there?
I don't think so, although that is the first game of the Stanley Cup playoffs, so if you come early, you can watch the hockey game with some fellow skeptics.
Woohoo! I have two highlights this week. One is the Degrowth Conference. Authors, economists, filmmakers, and activists will be discussing the question, can we simultaneously expand our economy and decrease our ecological footprint? It's June 4th, 2nd to 4th at SFU Harbor Center. Tickets are $30. You can get more information at www.de-growth.com. The idea of this conference is, everyone knows that I'm a bit of a lefty, and occasionally I will make a few disparaging comments about capitalism and the whole corporatist sort of culture. The idea of this particular conference is to sit there and say, well, we live in this particular society, this particular culture that has this insistence that we have to produce more next year than we did this year, and that the idea that if we continue on with this particular philosophy, at some point we're going to hit a ceiling where we just either can't grow anymore or we destroy the environment in doing so. So they're sitting there saying, well, in what practical way can we do a shift from this consumptive economy that we exist in now to something that is more of a steady state economy, which you hear about. Another highlight that I've discovered is HST Public Forum. It's a public forum on the HST referendum, which is going to apparently have both sides of the debate there. I hope some of us can show up for that and make sure they stay honest with the there are two sides to this argument. If you want more information about that, you can get that at www.hstpublicforum.ca. This is being held on June 4th, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the Telus Studio Theater right here on campus. It's part of the Chan Center. Mm-hmm. So, Ethan, what did you think? Sorry, just mentioning HST. You've heard that the government recently said that, hey, we're going to reduce the HST from the current 12% to 10%, and there we don't need a referendum, folks. Did that really bite for you?
Well, doesn't that mean they're decreasing either the provincial sales tax or the GST?
Yes, essentially. So that means that there's going to be a shortfall of several billion dollars in our budget.
Right.
Which apparently they're going to make it up in new corporate taxes. And again, because I have my points of view, but this, of course, is always, you know, they're planning to replace it with new taxes. Whether they actually do or not is the big issue. But has it swayed your view on the particular issue?
Well, you know, honestly, the argument for the HST, I'm relatively indifferent to. I'm not an economist. I'm not really an expert on taxation. My big objection to it was mainly through the anti-democratic process that the HST went through in being implemented.
What anti-democratic process? They campaigned on it. They had an election. They were elected on this particular promise, weren't they?
No. Which election were you following?
Oh, sorry. I get flashbacks of reality and this thing we now currently exist in.
Yeah.
So your big issue was...
Mainly just, I didn't like being told, we're not going to have the HST, and then we get elected, and, oh, wait, here's the HST. And, you know, there was a certain level of, I think, arrogance and trying to kind of almost sort of on the down low secretly pass this new system that people didn't get a chance to vote on. And then we had the referendum on it, which from what I understand, people said, we do not want the HST. And the government sort of said, okay, we'll deal with that in like 6 months. And then Gordon Campbell resigns and we're left with premier-elect.
But just to clarify, the actual referendum on the HST is occurring in a few months. It hasn't actually happened yet.
What was the one that we had?
We had a federal election, and then...
But we had a recall or something, didn't we?
We had Gordon Campbell, who quit, and they replaced with Christy Crystal or something.
Christy Clark, I know, but...
Christy Clark.
But before that, didn't we have some kind of...
What you saw was the petition to get the referendum on the ballot.
Oh, okay, I see, yeah.
So that was the whole big thing, was just to get the ballot question out there.
Right. And
so we haven't actually voted on it yet. But, you know, you're right. We're a democratic society. And as we've seen in our federal politics, right, mm-hmm. where we have, the federal government, the Harper government, which was, convicted of election fraud. It was found in contempt of parliament. The voters went to the polls. And they severely, severely punished the conservatives by... Oh, right. They gave them the majority. I admit, you know, people should be much more upset at about how this particular HST came. Because, I mean, they did. They said, we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it. We're not going to do it. They're elected. Oh, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you literally lied to the people to get elected. And now that you're elected, you're just going to blow it off. But are people going to get upset by that?
Well, seems that people get the most upset about taxes of anything in the world to get upset about. That seems to be the one that people will actually listen to. If you say to someone, I'm going to lower your taxes, their ears perk up, you know. So if anything will get them motivated to go to the polls, I suspect it will be about taxes.
Do you think they're going to remember, though? Because governments have a history in the past of doing the bad crap right after they get elected, so that by the time the next election cycle rolls around, people have forgotten. I mean, I am sure it's not by accident that although we replaced the leaders of both major parties in this province, there hasn't actually been a new election called for, right? I mean, mm-hmm. although Christy Clark is the head of the Liberal Party, she was never actually sort of elected as leader of the
Well, she
province.
Was elected leader of the party.
Yeah. And then she did win her seat by a very, very narrow margin, yeah, in what should have been an incredibly safe seat.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. You know, hopefully the electorate will stay informed. I mean, that's been the big question about elections in the past. But so anyway, this forum is happening, and listeners can check it out.
It's free.
It's free. There you go.
So no taxes.
Yeah, no HST tax on attending the forum. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, reminding you to visit our webpage, www.radiofreethinker.com, for all the show notes and blog posts about skeptical going-ons that you can read about. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, and dig and become our friend on Facebook.
Yes, do it now.
Aren't you going to say this is Don and something?
Well, I'm ready for you to say this is Ethan saying goodbye.
Well, I said this is Ethan.
But you didn't say goodbye.
Oh, well, goodbye.
This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
And goodbye once again on Radio Freethinker.
You really want to know what love is?
Yeah. Yes.